The rebellion continues right after nappy time. We talk with Andrea Blaugren Nevins and Kristen Riley about the other F word on this episode of Mighty Movie Podcast.
On the bus go round and round all through the town.
When we were younger, we were all nihilistic and didn't care. Live for today, live fast. I thought we were going to change the world.
It's the troublemaking is what attracted me.
Drink beer and bash stuff up.
Punk rock was supposed to be about no responsibility, no rules. I'm going to do things my way.
Maybe punk rock was never meant to grow up. But it did.
Having a baby changed everything.
And you're...
I get up a lot earlier now.
I know you're tired.
No, I can't take 20 Barbies.
How about this one? This one's like cool hearts and skulls.
Tough to be a punk rock hero and still be a good authority figure for your kids.
Homework, bath, bed. How am I supposed to shelter the F word?
The two dominatrixes on my arm? How do you explain that to a 4-year-old?
No! There's nothing really in the punk rock ethos that prepares you for being a dad.
My parents weren't really present.
Our dads weren't there, man.
Being gone all the time doesn't give you that bonding that you need.
How did we go from rebelling against our own parents to become parents ourselves?
The classic parent attitude to a kid, like, I brought you into this world, I gave you life. It's like, I just think completely opposite. My kids gave me life. You know, they gave me a reason.
Welcome to MMP. I'm Dan Persons. The F word in the title of the new documentary, The Other F Word, if you haven't guessed, is fatherhood, an occupation that's daunting enough, and even more daunting when the men finding themselves responsible for molding a new person make their living in the confrontational world of punk rock. Director Andrea Blaugren Nevins and producer Kristen Riley decided to explore the contradictions and weirdly concordances in that scenario, and have managed to delve into the lives of a wide variety of musicians, primarily among them Pennywise's Jim Lindbergh, but also Rise Against Tim McElrath, Red Hot Chili Peppers' Flea, and Blink-182's Mark Hoppus, not to mention Devo's Mark Mothersbaugh and Skate God Tony Hawk. They have returned with a fascinating and sometimes touching look at men who suddenly face the challenge of reconciling rebellion with responsibility and must now consider how the youths that form their own rebellion might shape their actions as fathers. So I was able to talk with both Andrea Nevins and Kristen Riley. You'll hear Andrea answer the first question on her own, and then Kristen gets first crack at the second question. And here we go. Let me start off by congratulating you on finally taking a bold moral stand on the idea that babies and children are absolutely adorable.
That surprised you, huh?
Yeah, I'm stoned, but good for you.
Thank you. We thought nobody had shown a spotlight on that.
I'm wondering whether you were concerned whether there was any trap in that, because, I mean, it is really easy to get into, like, the aw sort of response there. So were you concerned about that at all?
Well, no. That's so funny you would ask that, because we were actually told by each father prior to the interview, you can interview me, but not my children. So we did not go into this thinking kids. It was more about the dads. And then during the course of each interview, they were like, well, why? Okay, let me bring Wolfgang in here for a minute. Or Clara, do you want to say, you know, and then they would bring their kids in. But, and then Jim was definitely the trickiest interview and the trickiest one to film. We were always trying to chase him down and get him with his kids and stuff.
But if your question was, were we going for a soft sell? It wasn't what we were going for at all. We were going for a funny sell. We were going for the oxymoron of punk rock and dad. And that path led us down some very, very funny trails, but it ended up in a place that we found much more devastating and not awe. We found that each one of these dads, when asked the awe question, you know, what happens to you when you have a baby in your arms, they almost to a T, every single one of them welled up with tears and said, it was the most extraordinary thing. I couldn't anticipate it, no matter how many people might have told me that having a baby will change your life. It changed me in ways that I can hardly describe. And they didn't say this so much, but it directly, but what we found is that it really made them understand their own childhoods in a way that they hadn't fully processed before, and realized just how abandoned they were by their own fathers, and thus how much they wanted to double backwards to be there for their own kids.
You know, you do mention this idea of the sort of the cognitive dissonance of punk and fatherhood, and fatherhood is fatherhood and rock is rock. And when you were approaching these people, did you get any friction about, well, you know, I've got an image to maintain?
No,
that's a very good question. You know, that they, I think every other punk rock documentary that's ever been made has been about the punker. And so I think it surprised them that they were kind of happy to be getting questions that were much more personal and much more about who they are as human beings. Because often when you wear a costume, you get you get questions about the costume and not the being underneath it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was surprising to them, and of course surprising to us. We came in with all the stereotypes intact. You know, these guys are scary. They're going to be angry. They're going to be bristly when we ask them questions. And no, it was the opposite. They were incredibly tender.
And also their whole MO is authenticity. So for them, what you see on stage is who they are. It's just another facet of their personality. It's not a
It's not a costume.
Exactly.
They are anti-authoritarians, and they do walk the walk and talk the talk. But it doesn't mean that when they're with a child,
they're any different, frankly. I mean, and you see the differences. You see how Mark Hoppus is at home, or how Lars is at home, or how Jimmy is at home. And it's consistent with, you know, if you were to drop in at any time, they would still be that same person. And it's, you know, they just maybe pump it up a little bit when they go on stage. But they're very, very truthful. Very truthful. Which is part of what makes them really, I think, good fathers. For better or worse, they're going to tell you the truth, frankly. So that's refreshing.
Now, I gather you spent, well, the greatest focus of the film is on Jim Lindbergh, and I'm presuming that you spent, if not the longest amount of time, the greatest time span with him. How did what you observed with him spin out into or affect how you related to the other people you focused on?
Oh, that's a good question.
It's sort of a funny question. Jimmy agreed to do this documentary with us, but I don't think he entirely absorbed what that meant, that if we were going to follow him over the course of a year when he went out on tour, leaving his children behind at a very critical point. His oldest child was starting middle school, and he really felt very protective about her at that moment. And the tour schedule was going to be grueling, because at this point in the music industry, you can really only make money by being on the road. So there was that tension that we were going to film. But when it came down to actually being there with him when his kids had to go to a soccer game, verboten. He just decided he didn't want that much invasiveness. And yet, we had already started to tell a story. We were already sort of down the road. So in order to fill some of those gaps and show some of the relationships that dads who live this punk rock world have with their children, he began to say, well, why don't you talk to Josh Fries, because he has three kids, and why don't you, and his wife is pregnant, and why don't you talk to Fat Mike, because he's kind of more extreme, and it's going to be a bigger challenge for him to go to a PTA meeting because he's got, you know, naked ladies on his arm.
And then we'd go interview Fat Mike, and he would say, if you think I'm punk, you need to see Lars, and go, who has skunks on his forehead and tattooed on his forehead. So then we'd go to Lars, and...
And so it made for a much richer tapestry for us. We were able to tell pieces of the story that Jimmy felt protective about by speaking to friends of his who felt less protective about sharing some of those dilemmas.
You talk about this punk cascade, essentially. If you think I'm punk, da 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 da.
down the punk rock rabbit hole.
Did you find that the estimation of each person was right? Were you going down the rabbit hole, or was it a case of the grass is always punkier on the other side?
No, they're definitely.
Again, they're very truthful. I think they have a very good sense of who they are and where their place is in their subculture.
In the punk rock pantheon, they know exactly where they stand.
Do really well in a Scrabble game, all of us right now. But so I think that they were all very accurate, 100%. And even in the course of the movie, we sort of saw them all taking these different roles and parts, and we would kind of give them nicknames based on what they were contributing to the movie. Like Brett Gurwitz was our oracle, because he would just speak.
And he was able to distill ideas into a one sentence kernel.
And that's how he's looked at in the punk community. And they pretty much fulfilled those roles in our film.
So, I mean, I gather you started out with this idea of just doing the focus on Jim Landsberg, and it spun out to this. How did that impact pulling this story together? How difficult was it?
Oh, like that. Well, after we screened our 175 hours, is that how much we had?
Yeah, 180.
Then the work began. Mm-hmm. We kind of knew, but then...
I had a structure in my head, but then we transcribed every single interview, and I sat... at a cafe with giant folders of people's words, and just started sewing it together like a quilt. And I basically knew what the overall pattern was going to be, but how I was going to get there. It took a couple of months of writing.
Couple months.
You know, and then you see it, and you realize, oh well, I'm not actually. I thought that I was leading people emotionally in this direction, but it doesn't quite work. So let's rejigger. But we had a lot of material, a lot of really beautiful material to work with.
I'm just a little curious, just as an aside, I was a little surprised to find Tony Hawk in there. But there is a correlation between him and Tom.
You know what, we probably didn't draw it out quite as well as we wanted to, but a lot of these guys are still getting... One of the ways that punkers can get paid, and it's still it's very hard to do that in today's music industry climate, is to get their music used on video games. And Tony's been fantastic about using punk, old punk, new punk on his video games. So they still have a strong relationship, but Tony felt that his relationship started really young, that punk was what was being played when he was learning how to skate. And the punkers from the South Bay, and we talked to many of them, you know, we went farther afield, we did Chicago and Portland and Vancouver, but the guys, the bulk of the guys, have a very strong relationship with the skaters. It was a time that they were all growing up together, and the extremism of that sport and the extremism of the emotions in punk, they all feel quite wed to one another.
This also, I guess, provides an insight into what it's like for rock performers if you are not U2.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Or the Rolling
Stones. Middle class rocker. And there are a lot of them out there who are neither so garagey that they never get heard, or gigantic like you two and they're flying on jets and they live in mansions and everything can be taken care of for them. No, these guys are workers. You know, they're slogging it out there to put bread on the table and pay for, you know, new computers for their kids.
We were very careful in selecting our music to use only the guys' music of the guys in the movie in our movie for that reason, to help tell the story and to also help shine a light on their music again. We carefully selected only the songs that they've performed.
Mm-hmm. But it's also, I think, a revelation, and I've seen a few other documentaries that are exploring this, the idea that in the world of MP3s and essentially the fall of the rock industry, if you're not U2, you are out on the sidewalk every day. Do you, was this a discovery for you? Was it a revelation for you?
What was interesting is that some of our larger bands, like Rise Against, Blink had just gotten back together, but you know they've been touring now for the last 4 months. But Rise Against, they're very big. I mean, they sell out 10,000 head arenas, and he still has to tour pretty regularly. I'd say nine, ten months out of the year. And that was what was really surprising. And it's like what Joe Escalante says, that bands that used to leave once a year are now coming home once a year. And that reality, I think, for even the bigger bands was really surprising. They frankly are working even harder, you know, because it's in the moment for them. They're all definitely wrestling with it. It's why Josh Fries had to quit Nine Inch Nails. He had his third child, and it was too much for him. Very successful band.
It's a difficult balance. Jimmy was very careful to acknowledge the fact that they're not the only ones who have to struggle with mm-hmm. this idea of being separated from your family. There are soldiers out there who are saving our country who have to be away from their family
doctors.
For a really long time. Doctors to a certain extent, but not in the same way where you're
right.
away for
salesmen.
Months at a time. Salesmen. But just to shine a light on the fact that makes it very hard to be a good family man and to be a good father.
How do you think what you're exploring in the film in terms of the fatherhood for these men reflects on the music itself? Does it inform the music at all? Or?
A lot of the music that they're playing was written before they were fathers. But I think when you as an audience member hear it and understand their backstories, and that's something that was a big discovery for us too, what the backstory was for all these guys, it will inform their relationship with their children. So let me be more specific. These guys wrote this music at a very angry point in their lives. And one of the things they were angry about, one of the many things they were angry about, is the feelings of abandonment that they had because their dads weren't there. Their dads weren't there either because it just wasn't popular for dads to hang around home that much, or they would come home and smoke a cigarette and read the newspaper and disengage, or because a lot of their dads just left. And so you can hear that in the music, and when you hear these guys talk about that abandonment and then listen to the music, it's poetry and not just anger. And then when you see these guys with their babies and making every effort to be there for them and to raise them in a way that is different from where they came from, it again informs the music.
And I just want to be sure your next project is not going to be punk rockers and their kittens, is it?
No, and their kittens.
No. That's funny.
To YouTube, right?
No.
Punk rockers and their kittens, their pets.
There's potentially one music documentary on the horizon, but I think we're gonna. The next one is going to be non-music.
Yes, non-music,
non-kittens, non-children.
Andrea, Kristen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you
so much for talking to us.
The Other F Word opens next Wednesday, November 2nd at New York's Film Forum, and then throughout the month and into December, we'll be playing in major cities across the country. You can find the calendar and get more info over at the official website, which is theotherfwordmovie.com. And if you want to write me, the email address is dan@mightymoviepodcast.com. I love getting letters from you. And I am arranging more interviews for the coming months, but nothing is set yet. In the meantime, please do check out my reports from New York Comic Con. Got a few more still to come. And stay tuned, just in general, because the good stuff is yet to come. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This has been a production of Upstart Company NYC, copyright 2011, Dan Persons, all rights reserved, no unauthorized duplication permitted.